Bobbin.
Blog Talk Radio. Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson, and with me are some very good friends. First off, my co-host, one of my co-hosts, Andre Rodatis. Hi, Andre.
Good morning, Paula. How are you?
Good, and I know it's good day to you, sir. Good day.
Thank
because
you so much.
Here
thank
in
you
Colorado,
for.
But
yes, it's already noontime here.
Right. And we also have, of course, as we continue on our wonderful study, the unceasing campaign of the Master Seraphim, Mr. Neil Waldrop. Hi, Neil. How are you this morning?
Hi, Paula.
This afternoon, I should say.
Well,
good to have you on
that,
again.
Thank you. It's interesting that in English we make the difference between good morning and good afternoon. In French, where it's the dominant language in Montreal, where Andre lives, they just say bonjour, which is the equivalent of good day. And
good
that
day.
Lasts all the way to supper time.
Yeah.
They're so uncomplicated.
Although in the Quebecois being a little bit different, it has actually evolved into usage that as morning is coming along the evening is drifting away, bonsoir will be said from the time of dark till the time of the next morning, but it's come into usage to now say bon matin.
Really?
Really.
I think their colleagues who speak French in metropolitan France would find that strange.
They would. They would find that very strange. But that is Quebec. And Quebecois French is evolving, I think, to, if it's not already not only its own dialect, it's very, very rapidly becoming, I think, its own language. Anyway, I digress.
And one more person to introduce. I should point out that Crystalline is taking a day off today. She's spending some time with family from Wisconsin, so I hope she has a wonderful day doing that. But we have with us again a returning caller, Bob Diebold. Bob, thank you so much for joining us again.
Well, thank you for having me, Paula, and I'd say good afternoon. We've just crossed over 12 o'clock, but I would think more appropriately, happy Saturday.
Happy Saturday.
There you go.
Bon Universe. This covers it all. So we are in the middle of a wonderful study guide created by Neil, called The Unceasing Campaign of the Master Seraphim. And We've been moving through this week by week. We've been on it for several weeks now. And it's just been a remarkable study. And I'm going to turn it over to Neil, and he can catch us up where we left off from where we left off last week, and tell everybody how to download the study guide. If you haven't already done it, I think you're going to want to do that.
Thank you very much, Paul.
I'm sorry. I thought I'd just interject and mention as well that our other usual study group, you know, helper and cohort, Charles Olivier is not with us today.
Thank you. Thank you, Andre. That's right. Charles is traveling with his family, so he'll be back next week. And we sure will miss him, both him and Crystalline. So thanks for mentioning that, Andre.
Absolutely.
Okay,
take it away, Neil.
Thank you. I agree with you in expressing regret that we will not benefit from comments by Crystalline and Charles today, but we hope they're doing well and that they will join us again next week. In any case, as Paula mentioned, we are working on the study guide and the work of the Master Seraphim, a little bit more than halfway through. In fact, we're on page 10 of that study guide. And we will be proceeding through it, but first we are going to read out loud section 6 of paper 114 in the Urantia book, which is the Master Seraphim of Planetary Supervision. Now, for those of you who are listening and who have not yet downloaded the study guide, I recommend that very highly because it will help you understand what we are talking about as we proceed later. And while we are going through the reading of Section 6 in Paper 114, you will have enough time to download the study guide. Here is how you can do it. You go on the Internet to the following website, www.globalendeavor.net. Global Endeavor, one word, GLOBALENDEAVOR.net. And the link to download the study guide is toward the bottom of the home page. So now, without further ado, we will proceed to read through Section 6 of Paper 114. Andre, I believe you are willing to begin the reading with us, which is to say, starting from the beginning of the section through the paper that bear, I'm sorry, through the paragraph that bears number 4, the Angels of Nation Life.
Very good. Be glad to do so. Section 6, the Master Seraphim of Planetary Supervision. When the first Governor General arrived on Urantia, concurrent with the outpouring of the Spirit of Truth, he was accompanied by 12 Corps of Special Seraphim, Seraphington graduates, who were immediately assigned to certain special planetary services. These exalted angels are known as the Master Seraphim of Planetary Supervision, and are, aside from the over-control of the Planetary Most High Observer, under the immediate direction of the resident Governor General. These 12 groups of angels, while functioning under the general supervision of the resident Governor General, are immediately directed by the Seraphic Council of 12, the acting chiefs of each group. This council also serves as the volunteer cabinet of the resident Governor General. As Planetary Chief of Seraphim, I preside over this Council of Seraphic Chiefs, and I am a volunteer Supernaphim of the Primary Order, serving on Urantia as the successor of the one-time chief of the angelic hosts of the planet, who defaulted at the time of the Caligastia secession. The 12 Corps of the Master Seraphim of Planetary Supervision are functional on Urantia as follows. 1. The Epical Angels. These are the angels of the current age, the dispensational group. These celestial ministers are entrusted with the oversight and direction of the affairs of each generation, as they are designed to fit into the mosaic of the age in which they occur. The present corps of Epical Angels serving on Urantia is the third group assigned to the planet during the current dispensation. 2. the progress angels. These seraphim are entrusted with the task of initiating the evolutionary progress of the successive social ages. They foster the development of the inherent progressive trend of evolutionary creatures. They labor incessantly to make things what they ought to be. The group now on duty is the second to be assigned to the planet. 3. The religious guardians. These are the angels of the churches, the earnest contenders for that which is and has been. They endeavor to maintain the ideals of that which has survived for the sake of the safe transit of moral values from one epoch to another. They are the checkmates of the angels of progress, all the while seeking to translate from one generation to another the imperishable values of the old and passing forms into the new and therefore less stabilized patterns of thought and conduct. These angels do contend for spiritual forms, but they are not the source of ultra-sectarianism and meaningless controversial divisions of professed religionists. The core now functioning on Urantia is the fifth thus to serve. 4. The angels of nation life. These are the angels of the trumpets, directors of the political performances of Urantia national life. The group now functioning in the overcontrol of international relations is the fourth core to serve on the planet. It is particularly through the ministry of this seraphic division that the Most Highs rule in the kingdoms of men.
Thank you, Andre. Paula, would you continue, please, reading paragraph numbered 5 all the way through the end of the list, paragraph number 12?
Sure. 5. The angels of the races. Those who work for the conservation of the evolutionary races of time, regardless of their political entanglements and religious groupings. On Urantia, there are remnants of 9 human races, which have commingled and combined into the people of modern times. These seraphim are closely associated with the ministry of the race commissioners, and the group now on Urantia is the original corps assigned to the planet soon after the day of Pentecost. 6. The angels of the future. These are the projection angels who forecast a future age and plan for the realization of the better things of a new and advancing dispensation. They are the architects of the successive eras. The group now on the planet has thus functioned since the beginning of the current dispensation. 7. The angels of enlightenment. Urantia is now receiving the help of the third corps of seraphim dedicated to the fostering of planetary education. These angels are occupied with mental and moral training as it concerns individuals, families, groups, schools, communities, nations, and whole races. 8. The angels of health. These are the seraphic ministers assigned to the assistance of those mortal agencies dedicated to the promotion of health and the prevention of disease. The present corps is the sixth group to serve during this dispensation. 9. The home seraphim. Urantia now enjoys the services of the fifth group of angelic ministers dedicated to the preservation and advancement of the home, the basic institution of human civilization. 10. The angels of industry. This seraphic group is concerned with fostering industrial development and improving economic conditions among the Urantia peoples. This corps has been 7 times changed since the bestowal of Michael. 11. The angels of diversion. These are the seraphim who foster the values of play, humor, and rest. they ever seek to uplift man's recreational diversions and thus to promote the most profitable utilization of human leisure. The present Corps is the third of that order to minister on Urantia. 12. The Angels of Superhuman Ministry. These are the angels of the angels, those seraphim who are assigned to the ministry of all other superhuman life on the planet, temporary or permanent. This Corps has served since the beginning of the current dispensation.
Thank you, Paula. The final four paragraphs of this section correspond to the methods that the Master Seraphim use. Bob DeBold, would you please read these four paragraphs?
Sure, no, I'd be glad to. When these groups of Master Seraphim disagree in matters of planetary policy or procedure, their differences are usually composed by the Governor General, but all his rulings are subject to appeal in accordance with the nature and gravity of the issues involved in the disagreement. None of these angelic groups exercise direct or arbitrary control over the domains of their assignment. They cannot fully control the affairs of their respective realms of action, but they can and do so manipulate planetary conditions and so associate circumstances as favorably to influence the spheres of human activity to which they are attached. The Master Seraphim of Planetary Supervision utilize many agencies for the prosecution of their missions. They function as ideational clearinghouses, mind focalizers, and project promoters. While unable to inject new and higher conceptions into human minds, they often act to intensify some higher ideal which has already appeared within a human intellect. But aside from these many means of positive action, the Master Seraphim ensure planetary progress against vital jeopardy through the mobilization, training, and maintenance of the Reserve Corps of Destiny. The chief function of these reservists is to ensure against breakdown of evolutionary progress. They are the provisions which the celestial forces have made against surprise. They are the guarantees against disaster.
Thank you, Bob. We will now proceed in the study guide to the next question, which is question 8 on page 10. I would
Neil,
remind
can I,
the listener.
Can I interrupt
sure.
you real quick?
Yes, please.
We have a caller on hold, and I just wanted to ask you when you would like to take a call. If you want to do it before we start or after we get into this first section.
Thank you, and I think probably this would be a good time because it will not
okay.
interrupt something we've already started discussing.
Okay, I'm going to put our caller on. It's area code 203. Area code 203, you're with us on the Cosmic Citizen.
Hi, I was just wondering, wait, this is, I can ask a question, right?
Sure.
Sure.
Okay, I was wondering about, like, a person I'm talking to, if it's going to work out or not.
I'm sorry, can you say that again?
Like, I'm talking to someone, like, I'm kind of, like, in a relationship, but I don't know if it's, I don't know, like, exactly what's going on. So.
Let me explain the program. This is a discussion program pertaining to the work of the Master Seraphim. We have just completed reading Section 6 of Paper 114, and we were going to start discussing a question in the study guide. Now, are you asking about these topics, or are you asking something that pertains to your personal relationship with another human being?
Oh, I guess she dropped off. Okay.
Maybe called into the wrong program.
Yeah,
it sounds
perhaps.
As if she might have done that.
Yeah.
Just maybe.
I didn't know she might have been talking to an angel, so.
Well,
okay,
I don't
yeah.
think the Master Seraphim give advice to the lovelorn.
Probably not.
Although, of course, there is the interest in family matters corresponding to the home Seraphim, Master Seraphim Corps number 9. So one
there
would
you
not.
Go.
Exclude the possibility, but it certainly is not an expertise that they make obviously aware of to us.
Right.
In any event, for listeners, I reiterate that you would be much better off if you had in front of you the study guide on the work of the Master Seraphim, which you can download from the following website, globalendeavor, one word, no space, .net, N-E-T. So now we proceed to question 8 at the top of page 10 of the study guide. I would make a slight commercial for the way that the study guide is organized. We're going to start in this question with a quotation from paper 19 by a divine counselor, who in turn talks about origin, history, and destiny as being an appropriate framework. For the knowledge of the listeners, we sought to take this quotation into account when we prepared the study guide. In the first part of the study guide, we have the main heading origin on page 1, and then on page 3, the heading history since Pentecost, and then on page 8, destiny during the current millennium. This is the large section of the study guide that we are currently discussing, and now I proceed with question 8, which reads as follows. While describing the work of the Trinity Teacher Sons, a divine counselor states, quote, "Even in the study of man's biologic evolution on Urantia, there are grave objections to the exclusive historic approach to his present-day status and his current problems. The true perspective of any reality problem, human or divine, terrestrial or cosmic, can be had only by the full and unprejudiced study and correlation of three phases of universe reality: origin, history, and destiny. The proper understanding of these three experiential realities affords the basis for a wise estimate of the current status." A Divine Counselor, page 215 in the one-column edition, paper 19, section 1. Resume the question. Although the Divine Counselor's comments are not specifically directed toward the work of the Master Seraphim, and although the Master Seraphim are daughters of the Infinite Spirit instead of sons of Paradise Trinity, it is more than reasonable to conclude that during their arduous ascent to Seraphington, they received intensive training in the threefold principle that the Divine Counselor describes, namely, origin, history, and destiny. In your opinion, how do the Master Seraphim apply this principle in the course of their patient, persistent, and disciplined campaign aimed at influencing human beings on Urantia? How do they overcome a tendency among many current inhabitants of our planet to focus predominantly or even almost exclusively on events of the last 3 months and those expected to occur during the next 2 weeks? Who would like to comment on that question?
Well, I think it's a very good question. I think any commentary might start with a confession of ignorance, and that might open us up to some answers, because clearly your question presupposes that a lot of our thinking is in the short term, and I think the evidence preponderantly would support that implied conclusion in the question, that we don't see our governments on the face of the planet. We don't see business very often thinking further than in the case of business, with its need to please the stockholders, thinking beyond the next quarter very often in terms of stock price. Or we don't see government very often thinking beyond how they'll influence the outcome of the next election in terms of how they'll influence us. And so I think your question is a good one, because the Master Seraphim are certainly not ignorant of that tendency on the part of human beings. And the question would be then, you know, what is it that they can do to make us aware of things? And I think the initial beginning at an answer that might get us to some place interesting at some point would be to say, to allow us to experience, just like we're told wise parents would, experience the consequences of our short-term thinking and short-term decision-making. which is to say, when you think in the short term, you ignore the long-term consequences of your short-term thinking. And I think we're experiencing in the first world a lot of that right now.
Yeah.
And beginning to see just some of the consequences of, one, not thinking more long-term, but also not thinking in terms of the connectedness. And let me give you two examples of that. One would be that the current thinking in terms of many governments, you know, you could focus on one government, and the U.S. government is a very classic example of this, of continually deficit spending. There's an awareness that it needs to stop, but there isn't the resolve, really, of any particular political party or any particular politicians to really do much to stop spending more than the revenues that we're actually collecting. And that is not just true of the U.S. government. It's come to the fore in looking at the Greek government. It's come to the fore in looking at many of the governments of Europe. And it's a very big problem, and that would be an illustration of the temporal problem, an illustration of the fact that we're all connected in space here on this tiny planet. Would be most recently in the news the fact that Singapore is under a huge air alert that has to do with the fact that its neighbor across the sea, Indonesia, has so many forest fires going right now, probably some of them man-made, that Singapore is suffering the consequences of something it has apparently nothing to do with.
Mm-hmm.
So those are all kinds of examples that that might indicate both the temporal short-sightedness and the spatial short-sightedness. We don't realize we're part of a commons in space and in time. We don't think the consequences of our actions will generally persist.
I'd like to chime in, too. This is such an intriguing question to me, Neil, and I thank you for it. I think that the Master Seraphim, no doubt, were thoroughly debriefed before they came here. And they had a very good grasp on the origin and history of some of our problems, which Andre points out that we don't have a very good grasp on. And we know from reading the Urantia book that even the advent of our material son and daughter, the Adam and Eve, is little more than a fairy story in our in our world culture. And the advent of the planetary prince is all but forgotten. We really have no grasp on our origins or our history, and one of the things the Urantia book does is fill in those blanks marvelously, wonderfully, for us. And so we start thinking in those terms, and it's vital. We also don't have a grasp on our destiny. Here we are, this planet in space that's isolated, and our construct of thinking is so limited that, you know, we're not even sure if there's other life in the universe, even though the evidence from just the perspective of the Hubble is overwhelming that there probably is. We're still not sure, and main religions like Christianity don't believe it's true, don't believe in science like evolution. I mean, it's obvious our problems are so acute. In terms of just our conceptual poverty. And the Seraphim, you know, here we are at the heart of the Master Campaign. This is what they're trying to beef up. This is what they're trying to help us get a grasp on. And I'll give a couple of examples for me that are pretty poignant, how we fall into these traps. Disease is a perfect example. We talk about cancer, and we're endlessly on this campaign to cure it. We got to find the cure. We're racing for the cure. We're walking for the cure. We're driving for the cure. We're doing everything we can think of to find the cure, but never does anybody say, what causes it? You know, let's find the cause. If we can find the cause, maybe then we can affect the cure, you know. And the cause is certainly the origin of that problem. And we're looking for a solution without finding out what's causing it. And if we got to the bottom of that, we'd probably easily be able to just stop doing that, and or at least work on stopping doing that, and then we would more naturally find the way to overcome that problem. And another example comes to me because many of you know I adopted a baby from China 17 and a half years ago. And in that process, I studied the Chinese people quite a bit, and I researched the Chinese, the yellow race, and the Urantia book. And the Urantia book says something so poignant about the yellow race. It says that they worship their ancestors, and because they worship their ancestors, that makes them backward-looking. And because they're backward-looking, they don't have a lot of foresight. Well, I read a book on Chinese history, and in the 20th century, it points out, and completely unrelated to the Urantia book, it points out that the Chinese have been very reactionary in their problem solving. So they had a problem with birds, and so they killed so many birds that then they had this insect problem, and they were being overrun by insects, so they pulled up all their grass. So, you know, you can just see how humanity in many ways falls into the same trap. We're very reactionary. We don't have foresight. We don't have the depth of origin, history, destiny. We just kind of react to problems and then try to solve them, or we're maybe endlessly putting out fires. So, you know, your point about fire, Andre, is well taken. Colorado is burning up too, so.
Oh, yes.
Paula, thank you very much for these illustrations, which I think are very apt and important. For the benefit of listeners, I would simply add that particular views of one culture, in the case of China, for example, have to do with individual analysis, and we on this program are not making a general conclusion in regard to China or the Chinese people. I believe that Paula's remarks were in the nature of an illustration, and I appreciate that. I would like to turn, perhaps...
Neil, let me chime in on this, if I could,
yes,
for a second.
Thank you.
Here.
Yes, please, Bob.
I'd like to focus pick up on what both Paula and Andre said, but I'd like to focus on the second part of the question. How do the Master Seraphim, well, it's a how question, how do the Master Seraphim overcome a tendency among the current inhabitants of our planet to focus predominantly or almost exclusively on the events of the last 3 months, et cetera, or maybe even the next 2 weeks? Andre brought up the short term of business, and that's certainly a, well, it's a construct, I suppose, and it's probably an outcome of just the general way that our society runs in capitalism. And that's a general statement in itself, but we certainly know that occurs, and most of us do work in business, and most of us are driven by the stock market that's driven by day-to-day events. It's not even shorter the term events than that. So in thinking about the Master Seraphim, I was thinking, how do they operate? Well, they operate, as in the paragraph that I read there, which is the one that I keep going back to. They function as ideational clearinghouses, mind focalizers, and project promoters. And thinking about the mind is where they predominantly work, because they can't inject new thoughts into our mind because of our free will. They've got to highlight the mind focalizers. That, you know, I kind of pictured them, I probably said this a couple weeks ago, I pictured them sitting in some kind of a command and control area. Of course, it's my rendition of how they would do it. And they're seeing these concepts go by and ticker tapes go by, and they're saying, that there's a thought. We'd like to highlight that thought, and they would act on it. Well, how did they act on it, and why would they act on it? if we go back to what Paul was saying about the origin and history, you know, both the rebellion and the default, we've got a group of psychological archetypes. Call it the collective unconscious, call it collective mind, certainly is a global mind, that needs to be reconstructed. And if in fact, impatience, which is what we're told by the Melchizedek, is one of those reconstructions that needs to occur, then the Master Seraphim have to work in this global command center in one of the 12 areas to try and figure out how can they help to reconstruct, or how can they help even individual humans to begin to reconstruct these psychological archetypes to not be so impatient. So if I look at the 12, and let's see, I'm trying to find the industry here. Help me out. Which one is industry?
We're toward the end of the list. Number 10, I think.
Thank you. 10 is industry. So, we know from what a mighty messenger has said that the profit motive is good for now, but it's going to have to change. But the profit motive does drive us into these short-term thinking. So maybe the angels of industry can't really focus on that particular mental construct, but maybe, as Paula brought up, maybe the angels of health can do that. Or maybe the angels of, I was thinking of another area there, progress angels. So my thinking about how they might operate, being that we're told that they operate in global mind, in larger mind, not in individual mind, they've got to have some kind of cohortness with the guardian seraphim to be able to get a large group to form a tipping point so that what I like to call the psychological archetype should be reconstructed.
There are many different strands in these comments that all three of you have made, and I appreciate it very much. Unfortunately, we cannot pursue them all. Let me try to focus the discussion on a couple very intriguing elements that flow from what the three of you have said. Origin, history, and destiny is a very broad framework, and Paula mainly commented on the lack of understanding of the spiritual origin of the planet and the spiritual destiny as the authors of the Urantia book reveal it to us and analyze it. Now, that's extremely interesting as a question in itself, and we certainly have a context of secular society that has stepped way away from awareness of God's purposes on our planet. But my question to you has to do with how to interpret these words, origin, history, and destiny, in the context of the work of the Master Seraphim aimed at uplifting society and civilization. Do the efforts of all 12 core of the Master Seraphim aimed at diverse outcomes rely upon spiritual awareness? Or are we in turn talking about origin, history, and destiny of particular problems that might be unrelated to spirituality because they would not relate to the work of the third core, which in turn are the religious guardians? So who wants to bite on that question?
Well, the quick bite would be yes and yes.
Yes and yes. Well, please explain that, Andre.
Yes and yes.
Well, both to the fact that yes on spiritual issues and trying to make us more aware of spiritual origin and spiritual destiny in the larger context and in the broad overview, I think they're always trying to get us to think in the larger context. If any human being is close or striving for a higher awareness, of their own situation, their own place in the cosmos. They're trying to illuminate that truth quest and illuminate the truth of that larger context in that individual's mind. But I agree with you that with regard to any particular problem, since that is the way to understand any problem, clearly, as Paula was pointing out in some of what she was saying, in a root cause analysis, which was part of what she was alluding to, if you don't try to reason back, you know, to an origin point in in terms of your history, you don't really get to a root cause. You may be dealing with the most difficult aspects of your problem by looking at its history, but you may not see how this problem actually started. And I like what you keep pointing to with regard to destiny, that if you don't look at the actual possible ultimate result of not addressing a problem, you are ignoring destiny. You're also ignoring how that problem might actually resolve itself if you ignore the larger destiny, the fact that we do know we're ultimately going to progress, but we're not going to get there magically. It then leads us into sort of living according to maps which are incomplete, which I think addresses some of what Bob was talking about, you know, with his idea of the collective unconsciousness and archetypes. We very often have very, very unclear ideas as to what is motivating or guiding our thinking. And, you know, for instance, a large construct that currently operates in the minds of well nigh a billion people is the idea that mankind is sinful and is therefore experiencing the consequences of that sin and has had to be redeemed as a result of that sin. And that, in fact, will undergo an apocalypse as a, whatever you want to call it, a curative or a purge or some kind of thing on the way to reaching an ultimate destiny. And when you have views like that operating within the mass of human intellect, that has a very, very powerful effect. It hasn't just, it's, don't trust me on that. The likes of Carl Jung pointed to that in books like The Undiscovered Self, where he really addressed the idea that mass thinking has a profound effect and may have had huge implications in certain mass movements like those involved in Nazi Germany, and there are probably others that we could point to, but that's a stark one, because human beings all of a sudden, for a limited period of time, behave in ways that are uncharacteristically inhuman and or ignorant of their own humanity toward other groups of human beings. And so getting back to your original question, the Master Seraphim are always looking to illuminate that in any more deeply thinking human being. And we've already pointed to the fact that the reserve corps of destiny is made up of those who have championed or made sure to have as a mission in life some important goal that they are entirely dedicated to and dedicated to unselfishly. So that's maybe a beginning to getting at an answer, but I look forward to other people's ideas on this because I don't have anything settled on this.
Well, Andre, you began with yes and yes, but I think having listened to you, I would describe it more as yes and maybe. Well, that's all right. The question that I asked perhaps may not have been fully clear, so let me try it again.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, could you go ahead and clarify the question one more time?
Yeah,
yes.
Really.
The idea that I was reaching for is whether religious considerations are the driving matter of origin, history, and destiny in all these 12 fields. And I will show my hand by saying I don't think that's the case. Let me give the example. The angels of health, seraphic corps number 8. And the chief of seraphim describes them as follows. Paula read this paragraph. These are the seraphic ministers assigned to the assistance of those mortal agencies dedicated to the promotion of health and the prevention of disease. The present corps is the 6th group to serve during this dispensation. Now, what I'm asking you to do, in effect, is to interpret the words origin, history, and destiny in the context of health. Because it seems to me that this core of Master Seraphim is aimed at health. It's not aimed at religion. Now, when Paula mentioned the question of cancer and the search for outcomes to prevent cancer, she talked about the lack of an understanding of the cause. I suggest to you that the cause of cancer does not come from the Lucifer Rebellion. So please try to address this question, the relationship of the words origin, history, and destiny to the circumstances of the individual missions of the various corps of Master Seraphim, rather than just the overarching question of the spiritual nature of our planet and the spiritual destiny of humanity. Bob, did that help you?
I think so, Neil. It brought to light a thought I had. I'm going to go back a little bit to what I said about the angels of industry. And in fact, I've got about a 40-year history in total quality management. Back in the old days of late 70s, early 80s, the Japanese were the ones that were being so successful, not only at the cars, at cameras, etc., with the quality that Dr. Deming had taught them, that it was most of the American business CEOs that were going over to Japan. It took General Motors and Xerox about 6 or 7 trips before they understood really what they meant by total quality management. But one of the interesting things that CEO, I believe, of Mitsubishi, in his when he gave the plenary talk to the group there, I think this was in the early 80s, he was talking about vision. How do the Japanese businesses think forward? And, of course, their society had just come out of a semi-theocracy or a deeply religious type society, ancestor worship, etc. And, the answer was, we think 300 years ahead as to where my business will be. And it kind of shocked the American CEOs, because they're typically quarterly driven by profits from if they're a public company. I'm kind of tangentially getting to your question here, but the crossover might have been between a couple of these Master Seraphim groups that somehow were able to put these ideas in front of the short-term thinkers. I'm not sure if there's a religious crossover, but I think that over time, gradually, this has certainly changed the way that the American business has been operated. So, in fact, we are gradually coming out as the short-term thinking, even though it doesn't appear to be that way.
Can I get perhaps further comments from Paula? Because I referred to your remarks earlier about cancer, and I want you to have the opportunity to reflect further on this question of origin, history, and destiny in the context of health.
Well, this is such an intriguing idea to me, and I often think that when dealing with the problems of humanity, oftentimes the consequences are severe, so we think that the solution is so complex, it must be just so difficult. And I'll just share a personal experience by way of illustration. when I was a kid, you hardly heard of any breast cancer at all. And my mom's generation hardly experienced it at all. And my grandmother's generation, even less than my mom's generation. And suddenly there seems to be an epidemic of it in my generation. And, you know, almost every woman now knows some other woman who's had breast cancer or has had it herself. And there's just almost a hysteria about, you know, self-exams and, you know, getting your mammography and all of that, whatever, you know, very reactionary. And, by the way, thanks for pointing out my comments about the Chinese. I wasn't picking on them. I love that, those people dearly. And they're a brilliant race on Earth. And the Arantia book has many complimentary things to say. But that was just by way of example how we humans are very reactionary and we don't really do our due diligence to find out what's causing this. And I was praying about it one day, about breast cancer, and in all sincerity. And I was asking the Heavenly Father, why is there such an epidemic of breast cancer? And I went very deep into prayer, and I saw something. So, you know, what occurred to me was something that that happened in the recent past is causing this. Something that happened in the recent past. And that was, I was holding that because, you know, it, say in the last 30 years, because this epidemic of breast cancer kind of popped up suddenly. And now all of a sudden, you know, women are just like scared to death. And I went deep into prayer, I got a picturization in my mind, and it was crystal clear. And, you know, whether you, you know, whatever stock you put into this, it doesn't matter to me. It was the answer to my prayer, and I got it. What I saw was a bottle of Secret deodorant. I mean, it was just like as clear as a bell. Brand identified, the whole nine yards. And so often when I pray and I get an answer like that, that's all I get is just one picturization, one metaphor, and then I need to try to figure out what that means to me. And as I pondered this, I remember that when I was a young woman, Secret came online, and it was an antiperspirant. And it has a lot of chemicals in it to stop a woman from perspiring because, gosh, you don't want to ruin your clothes and you don't want to perspire. That's not very feminine, right? And then, you know, then the next thing I thought was women typically shave under their arms and then put this stuff on. I know from my experience, and I've had cancer, I'm a cancer survivor, so I've had to become very conscious of things that we put in our body. Our skin takes, whatever we put on our skin goes into our body, right? The skin, I mean, if that weren't so, then these medicine patches wouldn't work, but it is so. So what is under our armpits but a place where the lymph nodes cleanse, and we perspire because we're cleansing. Our body is cleansing toxins, right? So when we perspire, of course, it doesn't smell very good because toxins are being eliminated from our body, and that's a very delicate system right there. And I reasoned that God allows us to have hair in very delicate systems because hair protects the body. Hair protects from what goes in. And so, and you know, you have hair in your nose, hair in your ears, hair in every delicate system. The hair protects it. It's a protection mechanism. So you shave off the hair. Now you have no protection there. Now you slather aluminum chlorohydrate or these other gnarly chemicals in there, which clog the lymph system. And what happens? It backs up and goes into the breast. That was what I reasoned. And I made a personal commitment not to use antiperspirants anymore because they're not natural. And I made also a personal commitment, if I'm not wearing sleeveless shirts, not to worry about the hair under my arms because, you know, during the winter and stuff. And it's kind of, you know, we do a lot of unnatural things to our body in order to achieve a result. But what are we doing in the end? What is the price we pay? And so that's just a personal experience. I mean, I feel like much of the cancer that we experience is due to something very simple, just like that. And we think it's so complicated.
Hmm.
And it's
Paula,
not.
I would like to thank you for this very personal description. It leads me to have two reflections, and then I will yield to Bob or Andre, whoever wants to come next. The first reflection is that we appear to be talking about proportionality, the rate of incidence of breast cancer. I recall very specifically the recent HBO series about John Adams, the second president of the United States, which showed that one of his daughters in the late 1700s herself had breast cancer and ultimately died from it. So the disease is not new, but we may be talking about a different rate of frequency because mm-hmm. of some of the factors that you cited. Now, the other point that I would like to comment on is that your entire series of remarks did not have to do with the Lucifer Rebellion or the nature of God or the role of religion. You focused on factors directly related to health, and in particular this terrible disease. And in effect, by doing that, I believe that you solidified my point, that the words origin, history, and destiny need to be understood in the context of the work of the Master Seraphim in relation to the particular problem that a Corps of Master Seraphim is addressing.
Yes,
now, who would
Neil,
like to
Neil,
come
I,
next?
Neil? Yes, Neil,
yes,
can
Bob,
I follow
go
up?
Ahead.
That's exactly what I was thinking. Paula's approach to me it was a great approach. It was an origin, history, destiny approach. So when I went back and I took a look at the quote by the Divine Counselor that you read earlier, Neil, April 19, what I think that this Divine Counselor is saying is that there's wheels within wheels. And if we take an origin, history, and destiny approach for a particular local problem, for any reality problem is what he says, or she says, terrestrial or cosmic, if we take an origin, history, destiny approach for anything, any reality problem, terrestrial or cosmic, then we're taking a cosmic, you know, we're being true to the cosmos. That is really what we're doing, and it'll actually provide a wise estimate of the current status, which is what I think you did, Paula. You looked back, you took a look at the origin of it, you traced the history, and you decided action, which is what we want to do for the Supreme, don't we? So, I applaud the story there, Paul. It was terrific. And, you know, I think that's what you were saying, is I just had to jump in there so quickly because I thought that's exactly what you did.
I agree. Andre, do you wish to contribute?
Well, I was just marveling at that kind of connection, and there are so many other connections that are made with just something simple like that. There's a lot of not only logic, but there's not a lot that you can dispute about there being possible links to that. So I really find that very interesting and fascinating, and also the idea of how illustrative that is about that if you're trying to find an answer to something, there will be some kind of illumination. You may not get to it right away, and that seemed to be a relatively straight line answer, and I'm not saying I'm necessarily jumping on the bandwagon for that particular answer, but I'm not jumping off that bandwagon either. I will confess that I don't use antiperspirants either. I prefer deodorants, and for that reason, you know, it just never made logical sense to me that blocking what the body is meant to do is a good thing. You know, trying to handle the smell, okay, fine, but you know, goodness gracious, don't prevent the body from doing what it's doing. So, but very few people, you know, have that kind of thinking process. And it would seem to me that one of the things that the angels do is try to promote certain kinds of thinking. And you might look at, for instance, just the evolution over generations now in how we've been thinking about, you know, using cigarettes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that cigarette smoking, which a number of us here are of the age that we can remember a time where cigarettes were everywhere. They were at the coffee table. They were in the house. They were in the car. They were in the doctor's office. They were in the hospital waiting room. They were in the airplane. They were everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
There was not a place that you weren't seeing people smoking. And through, you know, a very gradual process that has had many opposing forces, and I think this would be part of what's indicated in this problem solving, is that very often in trying to get to a solution to a problem, somehow unwittingly, because of the origin of the problem or the way the problem has developed through its history, you have forces that line up on either side of the problem that work to build their rationalization scheme, their way of thinking about the problem that is organized around their initial attitude about the problem itself instead of the other way around, which would be data coming in, sorting through all the data objectively, and making some kind of decision and then changing one's attitude. But that's not what humans generally are like. We typically like to stereotype a problem in order to try to get to a quick solution that handles it so we can move on and deal with things that are more important to us. And that's not the way problems really get solved. Ultimately, problems get solved by somebody making that problem a number one priority and really getting to the truth of that problem. And origin, history, and destiny seem to be an excellent organizing principle.
Thank you. I think we have exploited Paula's insights into a very interesting example of this in ways that are productive for our discussion. I would identify one additional element that even precedes the question of an antiperspirant or a deodorant, and this has to do with the current fashionable conception of feminine beauty. That, after all, is the reason why women shave under their arms, because it is considered beautiful to do that. Well, this is an attitude of society, or perhaps an attitude whereby women who have adopted that practice believe that they are pleasing men by doing it. And now we are talking about issues that perhaps relate to the caller who dropped off the line, advice to the lovelorn. But in any event, we have a deeper issue of social attitudes toward appearance and beauty here that may indeed be a contributing factor to the question of breast cancer.
Sure.
I wonder if we could perhaps focus a little bit on the question of stimulating people in some field of endeavor who really are disposed to solve problems. Andre hinted at that. In effect, if the Master Seraphim are going to influence people who are innovators, who want to solve problems, it seems to me that the intent of this question is that somehow they have to influence these people to take broader account of the origin and the history and the destiny of the particular problem that they are looking at. Do other people agree with that basic conclusion?
Completely,
absolutely.
Neil. I'll go back to that paragraph that you read. It's any reality problem, human or divine, terrestrial or cosmic, can be had by a full and unprejudiced study of the correlation of the three phases of universe reality. It's a universe reality that we're dealing with. And at any level, at any cosmic level, at any terrestrial level, we're being told that it's the right approach.
Mm-hmm.
That's very helpful. Thank you. Do the other two of you wish to add additional comments? We've had a very interesting discussion of this question.
Well, I just think that oftentimes we attend right now in the world we're living, it seems like we apply science to every problem, and science doesn't always serve us so well as a solution to all of our problems. Certainly, we're living in a secular age, and I hope that someday we will more and more collectively ask for the wisdom of our Heavenly Father to the answer of problems that seem to just really, really stump us, and maybe even collectively do that. So, you know, we're definitely in a secular age right now where we rely on science to solve every problem. But we know that, that science, again, is just one approach to that problem. It's not the holistic approach.
Paula, I want to thank you very much for giving me an excellent entry into the next question, which has to do with
You're welcome,
impatience
Neil.
On the spiritual level. And so if no one else intervenes, I will proceed to question number 9. Number 9, in explaining and appraising the Lucifer Rebellion, a mighty messenger declares, quote, "Most of the liberties which Lucifer sought, he already had. Others he was to receive in the future. All these precious endowments were lost by giving way to impatience and yielding to a desire to possess what one craves now, and to possess it in defiance of all obligation to respect the rights and liberties of all other beings composing the universe of universes. Ethical obligations are innate, divine, and universal." A Mighty Messenger, page 616 in the one-column edition, paper 54, section 4. Continuing the question, when Salonia analyzes the default of Adam and Eve, she states, quote, "In estimating the results of the Adamic mission on your world, justice demands the recognition of the condition of the planet. Adam was confronted with a well-nigh hopeless task when, with his beautiful mate, he was transported from Jerusalem to this dark and confused planet. But had they been guided by the counsel of the Melchizedeks and their associates, and had they been more patient, they would have eventually met with success. But Eve listened to the insidious propaganda of personal liberty and planetary freedom of action. She was led to experiment with the life plasm of the material order of sonship, in that she allowed this life trust to become prematurely commingled with that of the then mixed order of the original design of the life carriers, which had been previously combined with that of the reproducing beings once attached to the staff of the planetary prince." Salonia, page 846 in the one-column edition, paper 75, section 8, resuming the question. "Thus, it seems quite reasonable to conclude that impatience played a key role in the exceedingly painful misadventures that marred the early history of our planet, the abject failures of the first two epical revelations. Are the Master Seraphim compelled to overcome a craving for instant gratification, or perhaps a desire for rapid and substantial improvements in my lifetime, among committed readers of the Urantia book or among other inhabitants of our planet Urantia? If we assume that endemic impatience really is an issue and perhaps an obstacle, what could the Master Seraphim do to neutralize or deflect it? In your opinion, how does the question of impatience compare with other challenges that the Master Seraphim must endeavor to overcome? If you believe that other difficulties are more important and more notable, please identify and analyze them." Bob DeBold, you earlier referred to the issue of impatience when you were talking about the previous question. Would you like to lead off on this one?
Sure. You know, again, you're going back to the question is dealing with the methodology of the Master Seraphim. And, you know, you've built really good context here, Neil, where you're talking, where you've provided a quote not only of the rebellion but of the default, and both the rebellion and the default, I would suspect, originated, you know, we know the history now, in this impatient idea, in this either self self-inflicted, self-recognized by Lucifer and Caligastia, and impatience on both Eve and Adam's plan that definitely went awry. So the question then gets back to, methodology of the seraphim, and I have to point back to mind, and I'm still, of the opinion that that they've got to help us with this overall, what I call group thinking. A couple of weeks ago we took the Fosbury Flop as some kind of a tipping point, but to get there really requires much slower and difficult conceptual constructs. Flight, for example, the Wright brothers and the four others that were doing that were just beginning to figure out how to put an aircraft in the air had to have the physics, had to have the understanding about what was air composed of. So there's things that have to gradually be built up, and it's my impression that that they've got to work in those ways to be able to do that.
Thank you, Paula or Andre.
Well, this question of impatience always intrigues me, an instant gratification kind of thing. And certainly Lucifer got the ball rolling there. And I'm glad you included that quote. I'm really intrigued by ethical obligations are innate, divine, and universal. So often we don't consider the effect of our actions on those around us, and how that will affect the people we love, and not even only the people we love, people we don't even know, and the repercussions of sometimes the simplest thing. And this kind of touches on the question you asked earlier too, getting back to the origin of a problem. I have raised three children now, and through their tempestuous teens, I often prayed, Father, please don't let them make a mistake that's going to affect the whole rest of their lives. Because, or please don't let them make a mistake that's going to have an effect on somebody else's whole rest of their lives. And the potential for that is so obvious when you live on this planet and you have to teach a 16-year-old how to drive, for instance, and you want to make them conscious of this very fact that ethical obligations are innate. It's not just about you and what you want to do. It's also about the benefit of many, many that you touch. Many that love you, many that may love you, many that you don't even know yet. And patience sometimes, when you stop to just reflect and be conscious of your actions in the moment, and in my opinion, Eve made her gravest mistake in all of this. She obviously listened to the sophistry of somebody who was tugging at her heart for something she wanted to do, and she wanted to make an immediate difference now. And we all want to make a difference in the world, I think. We all want to do something that has a lasting value. For the most part, humanity are good and altruistic, and if it weren't so, the truly corrupt individuals are the exception, not the norm, I think. And if that weren't so, none of us would survive down here. But we all want to do something good and right, and sometimes the sophistry is somebody plays on that, our desire to do the right thing, and it isn't the right thing, it's exactly the wrong thing. Her grave error, in my opinion, was not talking over this whole plan with her one peer on this planet, the one person that could have given her an honest, objective analysis of what she was planning. And she didn't want to hear it. And to me, that was her most grave error, is not asking him, what do you think? Should we do this? Should I do this? She took the whole thing upon herself to decide. And, that's impatience, but it's also, it just shows how even a perfect material being can be foolish.
Paula, you've told us a very interesting story in terms of appraising the psychological situation involving Eve. And in telling that story, you talked about teenagers and people growing up. I would like to probe a little bit for your net conclusions. Do you think that people automatically become more patient as they mature, or do you think that becoming more patient requires affirmative effort no matter how old you are?
Oh, yeah.
I got a quick thought on that one.
All right, Bob,
go ahead.
Well, you know, I always think of these, I love the statement in the papers, forget who does it or where it is, but it's about the lengthening your time units, and that those who are impatient have very short time units between one to the next. And I took that into account, Paula. You were talking about your children. My daughter's 26 now, but my nephew's 32, and I was always contemplating how do I increase their time units to become more mature? Because I think it's very difficult in the teenage years to shorten the time unit, but it might be things that parents do too. I remember as a teacher way back 100 years or so ago when I was doing some of those things, there was a tendency to try and get someone who was struggling with a math problem, tell them how to get to the next step, where it's much more beneficial long term to let the student self-discover. A lot of the education system has to change a little bit, has to have longer time units itself to be able to allow a teacher to do that. But you got me thinking about that, and I think it's very true. To expand the child's time unit is very very important to do.
Andre, you left also. Do you want to add to this?
Well, there was a bit of a leading question in there, but I think it's. It's almost so big a part of human experience that unless you're simply not paying attention, you do understand that you're going to have to work at yourself at becoming more patient. And clearly, in the vast majority of all children, patience is not an easy commodity to find.
Mm.
For one thing, their time units are very short. I can still remember how slowly the clock passed, second by second, in the classroom when I was in first grade, and it seemed like a minute was an eternity in the first grade classroom. And of course, today it doesn't seem like that at all. So there is the aging factor that can function in that, but I don't think it happens automatically. I agree with the leaning of the question, which is that in order to achieve patience, you first of all have to see it as a value. You have to understand that there is some value to waiting more long term, and that only comes through patience, where a goal which could never have come as a result of going straight line for a particular solution, but clearly had to be waited for because there was nothing else to do, unless you've been through that kind of a process, you don't learn the value of patience. And it was one of the signal things in the life and teachings of Jesus in terms of his early childhood development, was that he was taught how to manage the little garden plots around the Nazareth home with his mother Mary. And as an illustration of how valuable managing living things, and particularly plants, which there's no way to force a plant to grow, or let alone bear fruit, but with patience and going through the process of doing so, you do get to a point where you realize, oh, this really does work if you follow through with these steps and you don't give in to, say, well, I mean, the analogy with a plant would be to have a plant in there and dig it up all the time to look at the roots and see how they're doing and then stick it back in the ground over and over and over again. That would probably be disastrous for any plant to continually do that. But figuratively and literally, we do that with many, many other kinds of human problems, which we could analogize to that.
May I combine this analysis that you've just made with the point that Bob DeBull made earlier about time unit? The Master Seraphim are working to facilitate the growth and development in progressive terms of society and civilization. Time units are part of this. Process is the other part of it. It seems to me that time units and process can be summed up as how long things take. In other words, envisioning the growth of the plant that you talked about, Andre, has to do with understanding the cycle of growth of a plant and the period required for it, as opposed to believing that 5 minutes later you're going to see notable results. How can they encourage human beings to have this awareness of how long things take?
Can I share something here, because it just,
please.
Man, my heart is so full right now. Jesus said over and over again, time alone will ripen the fruit upon the tree. And we, that is so pointed that you guys have pointed this out, because it's just so true. We have to be willing to go the distance and wait the amount of time it takes for these things to come up to fruition. When Jesus was here, he made the statement, I have come to make a beginning of setting these things straight. 2,000 years later, they're not straight. So we have a sense of, okay, he came to make a beginning of it, and it's in progress. All of these things we're talking about, the tireless campaign of the Master Seraphim and the resident governor generals and all of the agencies that he set up, that's all part of his plan to set this straight, the outworkings of the Lucifer Rebellion, and to cure the terrible repercussions, including the Adamic default, all of that. This is all by way of cure, of setting things straight, in his words. And, you know, it just occurs to me when I look at the globe as a whole thing, I go back to the evolution of a child. And just like Andre's example of a plant, you know, as a parent, you study child development, child psychology, and if you're wanting to do a good job as a parent, you try to get a handle on the different stages they go through. And it occurs to me that we as a people, as a planet, evolve very much that way. We go through our very well-defined stages, and it's not a big surprise to them. They've seen millions of planets like ours evolve, trillions of beings like us evolve. They know that we'll go through our stages. And what occurs to me, and I mentioned it earlier about the tempestuous teens, because, you know, someone once told me, and it stayed with me, that, you know, your children need you when they're two because they're in danger, and your teenagers need you just as much or even more. And it occurs to me that teenagers are in danger because they have just enough free will and experience to be truly dangerous. And right now, as I look at our world as a whole in our evolution, I think we're in our tempestuous teens. And so it goes back to your question, Neil. Is patience just something that we, you know, have, or do we develop it as we mature? Well, we definitely develop it as we mature, because we get enough experience cumulatively to say, okay, and wisdom starts to kick in, and then we realize there's consequences, and I don't want to go there. It isn't worth it right now. In the moment, I feel like this is what I want to do, but what are the ramifications of all of this, and do I really want to go there? No, I don't. It ain't worth it. I'm just going to skip that for now and do something else. And that deals with everything we might do, from anger. Are we going to get angry? We have a choice about whether we get angry or not, or, you know, all of those ramifications of our actions. So right now, as I look at our planet, we're in our tempestuous teens. They are working feverishly to get us through that into our more secure, mature adult selves as a planet, where we would say, well, you know, yeah, we could blow up the world, but why in the heck would we want to do that? You know, where we really start looking about repercussions. So that's what occurs to me. Their parental guidance and influence is just that. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised if they don't pray for us every day. Father, please don't let them do something that, you know, is going to change the whole course of their history again, their destiny or their future.
I think this discussion of impatience is philosophically related to the question, origin, history, and destiny, that we talked about earlier during this program. The two ways of looking at it really are essentially the same thing. If we go back to a quotation that we read last week, the quotation referred to the need for people with experience in the field to be guiding change in social or economic terms. This is the quotation from an archangel on page 911 of the one-column edition, paper 81, section 6. And the quotation appears on page 9 of the study guide. So experience in the field connects to origin, history, and destiny, connects to patience rather than impatience. And in turn now, I'd like to pose to you the question of the scope of change. You talked about, Paula, the need to get where we should be and to recover from the mistakes of the past. But now I'd like to focus the question on the pace of change and the ambitiousness of proposals that people may wish to put forward in their own field. Which works better, very sweeping, broad, fundamental proposals for change, or something more modest?
Neil, if I could chime in on this one. Yes. One thing that we found, I brought up the idea of total quality management about an hour ago or so now, and the theme in business now is not abrupt change. It's about continuous small kaizen, I think is what the Japanese call it. Continuous small incremental changes that lead to a structure underneath. And it's the important structure underneath that has to be built. Otherwise, you have a house of cards if you grow too fast. A small business knows if it grows too fast, if it takes in a bunch of revenue, it can't hire people quick enough. There's all kinds of systemic issues with these time problems. So, it's a thinking process. It's a construct of thinking that needs to change, and frankly, that's changed in time over business, just in the last 30 or 35 years or so. And I forgot your question where I was going. I was going to make, you know, I've made the point, so I guess I'll ask
it
what was your question again?
It has to do with the relative merit of subtle, perhaps accretive change as opposed to fundamental sweeping change.
Yes, I think we all agree that that's exactly the way it's got to go. And I had a thought before that I didn't, I wrote it down. It's the Master Seraphim and how they operate has to be proactive, and they've got to decide when to do that. Otherwise, there's a reactiveness that will actually come in and make, well, I don't know if they make sweeping changes, but they certainly did that in both the rebellion. Well, not in the rebellion. It took a little while before any kind of changes, if we think about it, 150,000 years for Van and Amadon to stick around. Gosh, that's a long time unit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Can you imagine the conversation between Van and Amadon, and Amadon is proposing that they have a birthday celebration for Van, 140,970 years, and Van replies, well, we've gotten to the point that I am willing to celebrate only every 1,000 years that I'm alive.
Imagine that, perhaps.
But yeah. I agree that the time limits are very, very different in the case of spiritual beings who are here for a long time. A couple programs ago, we talked about the rotation of different Corps of Master Seraphim at different intervals. And that may relate to time awareness, too, in terms of the capacity for human beings to make changes. But I pose to you on the political level the comparison of the revolution in the United States that led to the forming of the United States of America as a political entity, which essentially concentrated on political matters and the way that human beings were going to be governed and enact laws, as opposed to the revolution in France that began in 1789 and which turned all of society upside down, not just politics, but the whole realm of society was fundamentally changed. Now, if we compare the results of those two events, I think the illustration helps my comment. In the revolution in the United States, politics was changed, but the basic elements of human life were not changed, and it worked. Whereas in the French Revolution, almost everything in human life was changed, and it led to turmoil for the next 50 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to me that this illustration, although it is strictly in the realm of political developments in history, epitomizes the advantage of relatively slow changes that operate individually, instead of trying to do everything at once. Do others agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, one of the concepts that goes along with that would be the notion that in order for a change really to take hold, it has to be accepted by people. In order to be acceptable by people, they have to see how they can grow into the change. They have to actually. And even if they can't see how they can grow into the change, they have to be willing to or be motivated to grow into the change.
Right.
One way or the other. And so, you know, people have at various periods of history been more or less willing to go to war, for instance. And the motivation of a younger man to want to go to war in the 1940s during World War II is something in stark contrast to what a younger man was willing to do perhaps in the 1970s in the Vietnam War. And, you know, what were the reasons behind that? There was a clear and present danger that was being presented in World War II that was much more amorphous and dubious from various perspectives, and dubious also as to whether or not there was an ability to, quote-unquote, solve that problem ourselves or whether we had the right to in that situation. And people fell on both sides of that issue, and it was quite a divisive issue in the course of history. But those kinds of things would be, say, examples of it was somehow very easy to get young men on board with going to war, putting their lives on the line, I don't think they considered their lives any more cheaply than people in the 1970s. Probably all the more they considered their lives valuable, and yet they were willing, more willing to do it than young men in the 1970s, even though there were many, many, many young men that did go to war back then. And now we have a situation which has evolved where we now have young men and young women that are going to be in combat roles. And without drilling down to a specific issue like that, it is a very interesting evolution in this particular kind of a problem, because you can imagine there's going to be all kinds of unforeseen consequences, and some of them foreseen, in having women in combat roles, which is going to have an effect on our willingness to go to war at various times, and many, many other issues surrounding the institution of war.
Well, I, for the sake of just elaborating on your thought, Andre, I would suggest to you that the factors you've just identified may also have an impact on the ability of human beings and governments and so on to solve problems without going to war.
Mm-hmm.
But
yes.
But in any case, the illustration is useful because it brings into very clear light the interrelationship of individual issues with the whole pattern of human life and behavior. And I think, in effect, Paula, you commented on that before about how people can adjust to new situations and put them into the context of their own lives. Am I correct?
Yeah. And I think that, you know, just pondering this idea of taking things one step at a time and having the patience to move forward to the future, and we have a vision of the goal or destiny, and I think sometimes that gets in our way, that we know what we want, we know the objective, but oftentimes we think that any means to an end. And, of course, you know, the Urantia book says, you know, the act is ours, the consequences are God's. So that means God is holding the consequence, and all we really have is the act. And so the means is all important. The end, we can trust that the end is there if we just follow step by step the process. And as we were talking, it occurred to me that, you know, the default was more about how can you show the children of Earth how to be patient if you can't be patient yourself. And, you know, that there's another quote from the Urantia book that says there is no shortcut to perfection. It's a painstaking process. And it's a slow process. There's a certain amount of acceptance and willingness to accept things the way they are and to make progress however much you can in increments that make sense, rather than to try to, you know, I always think of an analogy about a person who goes into a doctor and needs multiple surgeries. And with multiple issues, and the doctor is going to, and again, it's triage. They're going to do what they can do right now, but they're not going to put this person through multiple surgeries all at once and probably kill them because they can't take that. It's not going to work. So even more so true for us on this planet with all of the difficult problems we have is to patiently, persistently seek to solve what we can solve and change what we can change. And, you know, Andre's analogy of war is so good for me because, you know, we just don't seem to be willing to give peace a chance. We use war as a cure-all. It's kind of like, you know, drugs. Drugs cures everything. There's got to be a drug for everything. You know, drugs are good. You know, you got a problem, take a drug. It's all related to, you know, war is the cure-all. For all social ills, you got a problem, war, just go to war, and that's, you know. But the book tells us it's become socially bankrupt. It's strong medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And only patience is going to get us through this period of time where we immediately want to use that as a solution. So it's interesting. Patience looms large.
So I got thinking, Paula, about Neil's question, and that is, you know, when is the change too much change and not really incremental change? And I think that's a thorny problem for me to. I don't know if I have the answer to that yet, because we've talked a lot about where we all agree that this this idea of impatience could be overcome by an approach of origin, history, and destiny to any reality problem. But I'm not so sure I have a good feel, and maybe someone here can help me with really the response to Neil's question, which is, when is change too much change?
I will soften this for you by stipulating that there may not be one answer that suits every situation and every circumstance. But the question, it seems to me, is an important one. Someone commented to me once about a leader, saying that a leader is 2 steps ahead, not 10 steps ahead.
Uh-huh.
That anyone who is 10 steps ahead is not a leader, because no one is following. So
they've left them
in wonder,
the dust.
Well, he's off in the wilderness by himself.
Yeah.
In effect, human beings who wish to work together to achieve something have to have at least a degree of a shared vision of what they're trying to achieve. And the Master Seraphim, working with innovators, it seems to me, have a duty to damp down enthusiasm for sweeping changes that no one will follow.
Yeah, that's a very good point, Neil. Well, how do they do that?
Yeah, how do they get people to be a little bit more realistic and a little bit more modest without completely damping their enthusiasm for striving energetically?
Go ahead.
Sorry, I'm good. Go ahead. No, please.
Well, my only thought, I just wanted to say that, you know, clearly the idea of leadership is important, and the idea of transitional breakdown and the kinds of emergencies that are pointed to that they're the guarantees against disaster, the reserve corps. These are mature human beings, that have a mission and don't have their self at the center of the mission. That's number one. Think of how many missions there are on the face of the earth that don't have a self at the center of a mission. There may be a lot, but there's many more that do have a self at the center of a mission. So part of what happens is having someone who has actually the mission in mind and the success of the mission in mind, and who is actually so dedicated to the mission that they have achieved some competence regarding the mission. And I really do appreciate Bob having brought up TQM a number of times. You know, I was privileged to be in a project management environment for a very short period of time and got to see how, you know, really well-trained project managers worked. Some really good, even a good Six Sigma black belt that was on our team, that was very, very interesting on seeing how they went to root cause analysis, how they really did have this, you know, for lack of a better term, it was an origin, history, and destiny kind of approach. It may not always have looked clearly at destiny, may not always get clearly all the way back to an origin, but it essays to do so. It tries to do so. So I think to the extent that anybody is minded for the mission, that they've, number one, put themselves to the side, and number two, have then achieved a certain maturity by that they could actually function in a leadership role where they could, quote-unquote, allow cooler heads to prevail and perhaps convince people to make a more incremental change as to oppose to a more sweeping change, that would seem to me to be part and parcel of how this gets done. It doesn't get done without human beings achieving some kind of self-mastery, which gets back to this business of how important is spiritual versus overall balanced progress in a human life.
Hmm.
We talked before about how long things take, or at least I asked the question. Is that really another way of expressing history? In other words, how long things take could be considered, at least in the context of previous developments in your field, and what happened after particular proposals were made and either adopted or rejected. Is this a wisdom factor that contributes to patience?
Well, people consider the wisdom of that for a moment. Let me just briefly station identify and let people know in the last 15 minutes of our show that we are on Blog Talk Radio. This is the Cosmic Citizen, and you're listening to the unceasing campaign of the Master Seraphim 5, Destiny 2. How do we best deal with destiny in the context of origins and history? Back to you, Neil.
Thank you very much. The question has to do with the contribution that wisdom makes to this overall discussion, perhaps as a way of unifying an awareness of origin, history, and destiny, and combining in patience in the context of understanding how long things take. So are the Master Seraphim, in effect, stimulating the development of wisdom on the part of innovators?
Well, I think so, Neil. And you had brought up a thought about, I asked the question, when is change too much change? And you brought up the thought that made me think about Ilya Goldratt has this theory of constraints. And the story he tells when he writes the book, he says when he was a Boy Scout troop leader, he had a bunch of boys that were teenagers, and he was trying to get them to go up a steep hill. And they kept getting too far apart. I think you were talking, the thought that you had there, Neil, and I think everybody came up with the idea that the leader that gets out too far loses sight, like the rabbit gets out too far in the race, loses the chance to have the race beat a record. What he had to do was, because he had the faster boys in front, and he found always that the slower boys lagged behind, they got lost, they came up into all kinds of issues. So the theory of constraints is as simple as taking the slowest one and putting him first. And it was the getting to the wisdom idea. I don't know if that's really wisdom, but he got the knowledge that he would be teaching not only patience of the boys behind who were willing to go as fast as they want to get up the hill, but also to truly understand that it's a group effort. And in fact, the slowest person that's at the back of the pack will not be part of the group if he's not there.
No, I agree with you. I agree with you in your analysis and your in effect pointing up the dilemma of someone who is particularly insightful in conveying his or her ideas in ways that others can understand and accept if they're perhaps not quite as intuitive or logical as he or she is. I don't know that there is a single solution to that. We talked about experience before, perhaps building patience, but how does experience, how does wisdom build a capacity to communicate with other human beings? Paula, do you want to add to that from your perspective of having brought up teenagers?
Well, I think it meets them where they are. And Jesus was the prime example of it. He met us where we were. He didn't expect us to be anybody we were not. He didn't expect us to be advanced beyond the place where we were advanced to. And he built on what we had. And I think the angels, he sets that beautiful example, of course, as does the Heavenly Father, to meet his children where they are and to help them advance the next step. And I think all of the universe of universes and every loyal agent of God the Father does exactly that. The Master Seraphim are no exception. They know exactly where we are. They're meeting us where we are, and they're helping us to take the next logical step. And on the path, it's like climbing a ladder. You can't skip 10 rungs. you can't reach that far. You have to do the next step and then the next step and the next step. And they know what those next steps are. And I think wisdom, you know, they're certainly helping us cultivate the wisdom to understand for ourselves what those next steps are. And what occurs to me is, you know, looking over the history of my own life, even how some of the significant changes that have happened with civil rights, and even most recently with gay marriage. And I know that, you know, there's a lot of, there's a whole panoply of opinions about that. But having some dear gay friends myself, and having seen how they struggle with who they are and being accepted for who they are and having the courage to say, no, this is who I am, whether you like me or not. And how this is changing. And it hasn't been all that slow. If you think about how long that, you know, for instance, with civil rights, how long certain members of segments of society have been held down and stigmatized and treated badly just because of who they are. And that's changing rather suddenly now. And it's a good thing. And so we're seeing it right before our eyes. But what we don't take into account maybe is the long, arduous process it took to get here to now where, you know, certain segments of society are enjoying greater acceptance by the rest of us. It took a long time to get to this point. Now we can enjoy the fragrance of acceptance. And the peace that comes with, oh, hey, the sky didn't fall. You know, no dire consequences because we've openly looked at gay marriage and maybe embraced it and said it's okay. You know, gay people are people, too. And
well, thank you. And I'm sorry, go ahead, please.
No, well, that's just my point. You know, sometimes we get to the place of change and it's just a matter of realizing that, okay, this is going to be okay. You know, the world's not coming to an end because of gay marriage or because of whatever, you know, it is that we build up in our minds as almost an insurmountable, you know, problem, and it's not really.
In the concluding minutes, I'm going to do something which is not really on the program, but I'd like to apply this issue of origin, history, destiny, patience or impatience to the Urantia book itself. We're told that it took a fair amount of arranging for the revelation to be prepared and put before human beings. And in effect, I'm giving the three of you a license to speculate on the timeline that the revelators have for achieving major upgrades in human consciousness by the impact of the fifth epical revelation. This is not on the agenda, it's not in the study guide itself, but I think it is an extremely interesting application of the principle of origin, history, and destiny, and the question of impatience that we've been talking about before. And I suspect we could devote quite a long time to this discussion, but we have only a few minutes left. Who would like to bite on that one first?
I'd love to just quickly bite with some reverse psychology and just say we should have achieved all our goals by now, shouldn't we?
If we achieve all our goals, that's a cue to formulate new goals, don't you think?
I would say so. No, clearly, with the number of times that they, you know, refer to the phrase 1,000 years, you know, and not depriving us of creative speculation for 1,000 years, and there's a couple of other places where they refer to that. clearly, they're thinking long term.
Mm-hmm.
They would like us to act, but they would like us to act wisely and lovingly. And patiently, I would assume, in what we do. And I really like the idea of what people have been saying about incremental ideas. Bob, you said it very well. The incremental ideas that the Japanese are talking about that build a structure underneath. we do not need any more House of Cards or any more ideas that try to Roman candle us into some kind of success, because we all know what happens to Roman candles.
Well, and here's a thought about patience, too, you guys. Patience is employed in dealing with other people.
Hmm.
Patience means allowing them to be who they are. If you lose patience, that means that you've decided that they're not doing it right. And so for me, patience is, you know, try in terms of, you know, what you pointed out, Neil, the revelation. Being patient, obviously we all found the book, we wanted to tell everybody about it, everybody wasn't interested. And we learned that, well, this is going to be a long slog. I mean, if we didn't learn that, then, you know, it's just obvious to me. There's slow growth went without saying. It's slow growth comes with full effort in everything we do. And to me, patience is not giving up. Don't give up. Don't give up on humanity. Don't give up on yourself. Be patient. Be patient with yourself. All of these things take time. But don't give up. Don't quit trying. Trying is essential to growth. Effort is essential to growth. So patience is, to me, there's a measure of acceptance for who you are, where you're going, and also acceptance for who everybody else is and where they're going. And the desire to just keep applying effort to the problem and not giving up.
Well, that's
Bob,
a good point,
Paul. It's your turn for the
problem. Yeah, if I could just follow up Paula's thought there, Neil. Yes, you have to deal with people, and that might be why for those ranch and citizens that don't have children or don't raise children, they're going to do that on the mansion world because,
mm-hmm.
as we've all talked about it, children teach you how to expand your time units as well as learning how to be patient with others. And it kind of brought me to this idea of service, Paula, when you were talking about dealing with others, because service is really where we understand not only ourselves but also the aggregate whole, because that's where the content of our soul is going to be built. That's where this whole Maurantia, I think, cosmic psychic circle decisions can be made when we're patient in our service.
Hmm.
Beautiful.
And of course, the underlying context here has already been identified. I've lost the focus on which of you said it, but you all said that the Master Seraphim are patient. In effect,
God bless
them. that they have been in this campaign ever since Pentecost. That is to say, some of the core of Master Seraphim have been at it since Pentecost, but the structure of activity, the unceasing campaign of the Master Seraphim, has been going on for the last 2,000 years, and we can certainly anticipate that it will continue for quite a long time. Andre mentioned 1,000 years as a timeline that the Revelators point to in various contexts, and I certainly agree with him.
Yeah, me too.
I think the timeline that we're now facing is the fact that we're 2 minutes before the conclusion of the program. Paula, do you have concluding remarks on that level?
Well, and we're going to continue with this wonderful study, and thank you for our listeners. I've gotten a lot of great feedback about this series. I appreciate that you're enjoying it so much. I know I am. This is really for... designed for your Rancho Book readers, but I hope that those listeners who have come in to listen to this story of the unceasing campaign of the Master Seraphim have gotten a lot out of it in terms of what the angels are doing for us and how they're working diligently to help us solve these problems that exist on our world. And there is hope. And we're going to continue on next week with the Unceasing Campaign of the Master Seraphim. And Neil, thank you so much for leading us through this study guide. It's just been such a great study, and I really feel so much more connected to the Master Seraphim than I did before. You know, and so
well,
much
I'm delighted that you do, and I hope that others share your impressions. I have found it a great privilege to be able to discuss this with you, and I think the energy that we spend in seeking to understand their work will help us make our contribution as best we can in whatever field of human life we happen to be involved in.
Beautiful.
Well, thank you, Neil, and thank you, Bob, for joining us. And I guess we'll take up with question 10.
We will indeed.
Perfect. And
thanks,
we'll be here again next week discussing the Unceasing Campaign of the Master Seraphim. And we're going to get through this study, and it's going to be rich as it has been in the past. So thank you both for joining us. And, Neil, thank you so much for your stalwart effort to help us get through the study. It's been so worthwhile.
Thank you very much. Bye to Bob. Bye to Andre.
Bye
to you, all of you.
Bye.
And see you next week.
Thank you.
And until then, bye for now.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.